These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes in length. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spend just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Neolithic Europe. The lecturer is Professor Jeremy Adams. Professor Adams received his Ph.D. in history from Harvard in 1967. From 1966 to 1974, he taught medieval history at Yale and also served in the interdisciplinary History, Arts, and Letters program there. In 1974, he began teaching history at Southern Methodist University, where he continues today. Professor Adams has held visiting positions at St. Mary's Dominican College and Loyola University in New Orleans, as well as in the SMU overseas programs at Oxford University College and in Madrid, Toledo, and Paris. He has written and lectured widely on topics medieval, ancient, and millennial, with his specialty being medieval intellectual history. Professor Adams has won numerous awards for teaching from various institutions, including the Yale and SMU chapters of Phi Beta Kappa and the Danforth Foundation. Moreover, the SMU student body has awarded him the Outstanding Professor Award several times. Professor Adams prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, diagrams, maps, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. Definitions and Environmental Preconditions.
This is a course in the Neolithic prehistory of the West, especially Western Europe, especially Britain, and it stretches across nearly 10 millennia of time, from 10,000 or 8,000 BCE in Western Asia to 1350 BCE in Southern Britain, by which time Stonehenge was complete. Now, you might ask, why study Neolithic culture? Why should you? Or why did I? Why get involved in it at all? And three answers suggest themselves to me, some of which I hope will be of use and I hope of persuasion to you. First of all, there's the old answer. It was there, like Mount Everest, but that has never seemed to me a very compelling reason to get involved with anything. Much more important is the claim that the Neolithic era, its culture, is the foundation of all later Western culture and history. Gordon Child asserted that it was. Gordon Child, a remarkable, pioneering professor of prehistoric archaeology, of whom I will say a great deal more in the course of this course. In the Annalista School, the so-called School of the New History of Paris, now of much of the Western world, of the history departments of much of the Western world anyway, would certainly agree. The Annalista tradition says we should stop paying so much attention to mere events, battles, kings, reigns, the sort of thing that has been classic political history. Instead, we should look for the deep structures of human life. And according to the Annalista, there have been two or three times in the history of this human species to which we belong when fundamental modes of life, fundamental structures of existence have changed radically. And at least one of those was the Neolithic Revolution or Agricultural Revolution. I'll be talking some more about other such structural revolutions as this course goes on. Well, I certainly found this line of argument convincing, and I did that in the course of teaching a course which I've taught in my university's summer program in University College, Oxford. It's a course on the historical landscape of England. And as I taught this course to my students for the first time, I was, of course, as a medievalist myself, fascinated to make meaningful to them the medieval contributions to that landscape, the castles, the cathedrals, the colleges, the manor houses, the peasant field systems, all that kind of thing. But as I went deeper and deeper into the subject, trying to make it make sense to my very modern students, I found that I had to go back to the early Saxon invaders, to the Celts who resisted them, to the Romans, to the Celts of the Iron Age before the Roman conquest, to the Bronze Age, and finally to the Neolithic. And then, when I was back there, it all made sense, to me at least. And I think that the Annalista school is backing up Gordon Child's claim that most of what we have experienced in early modern, or at least, or even in modern Western culture, was really fixed in its main lines, in its fundamental deep structures by the Neolithic era, by the culture of the Neolithic Revolution. And now there's some unpleasant things one has to admit about the Neolithic contribution to the future, even to the future as close to us as our own post-industrial life. Lots of nutritional bad habits that kill us and that we're trying to do something about are direct contributions of the agricultural revolution. And there are bad habits of class stratification, often very cruel, that we're doing a pretty good job of getting rid of in modern egalitarian industrial democracy. And then there's the beginning of warfare, although I now think that warfare as we know it really got going later, in the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. And then there's also the fact that much of the study of anything Neolithic involves a kind of gloominess, a kind of death obsession, bones and burial habits. That's most of what we have to work with. In the absence of written texts, we've got to pay attention to the way Neolithic people had themselves buried and what those burials tell us about their lives before that fatal and ultimate event. And I think that as we try to reconstruct Neolithic culture, we get a sense, probably a valid sense, not just because of the dominance of that kind of documentation. We get a valid sense that Neolithic people, living their short lives, were indeed obsessed with death. Perhaps as much as the Egyptians, and almost certainly less optimistically than at least the better off Egyptians. Now this fact, which is depressing in its own way, suggested to me yet another final reason, another final answer to the question, why study the Neolithic? Precisely, it seems to me, it's useful to study the Neolithic if we wish to confront death. What do we do about the fact that we live so briefly and in such restricted space? Well, one thing to do, as I said, is to confront death and in the process to defy it. How can we do that? We can explore the deep past. We can explore other parts of the world. And by looking at and trying to come to terms with those distant times and distant places, we can, in a sense, possess them and thus break the limits of time and space which bind us about so tightly. That kind of motivation was important to me a quarter of a century ago. As time goes on, it gets to me even more compelling, and I hope that either it or one of the other two answers I proposed will provide some justification for sticking with this course. This course begins with some essential definitions. Most courses do. And a discussion of the environmental conditions that were necessary for the invention and maintenance of agriculture and pastoralism. The first of these is the neothermal climate change, which was completed in northwestern Europe and the British Isles in the course of the 8th millennium BC. Some say it got going in 8300, about the time it was complete in Western Asia, where Neolithic agriculture began, between getting fixed in about 8300 in Western Asia and getting going in the British Isles in 8300 from that time up till it got settled around 6,000, 5,000 BC in the British Isles, we have a movement of climate which presented the essential preconditions for the agricultural revolution. We're going to start off, of course, looking at the place where the agricultural revolution began in West Asia, and we'll look at four case studies which I think are very revealing about the legacy of the original Neolithic culture which spread so effectively to Western Europe and especially to the British Isles. First of these is Jarmo in present-day Iraq, Jericho in present-day Palestine or Israel, depending on the shifting political geographical designations of that troubled part of the world, Kirakhitia in Cyprus, and Çatalhöyük in Turkey. Then we're going to track the way in which this highly successful alteration of human life, the Neolithic Revolution, spread. What occurred was a kind of diaspora, a scattering about of its culture seeds, which went first of all to that place that we've looked at already, Kirakhitia, and then spread into Europe proper, up the Danube Valley and along the coastlines of the Mediterranean. We'll pay some attention to the skillful use of stone construction that made the culture of Kirakhitia so outstanding. And then look at some of the great wooden thatched longhouses of the Danubian people, a type of building that has remained very much a favorite of European culture into the early modern era. And we'll look at what is suggested about a religion of death from the data we find in a wonderful and mysterious and spooky place, the Cueva de los Murciélagos, the Cave of the Bats in southeastern Spain. But in order to get a clear and multidimensional sense of our Neolithic forebears, as is true of anything, I think we have to take a look in some depth at some case studies. And we're going to look at two case studies here. And they're going to be in Britain, Avebury and Stonehenge in the south of England. Why choose those two sites and that country out of the whole range of Western European experience with the Neolithic culture? Well, I think whatever our genetic ancestors, whoever our genetic ancestors may be, any member of a modern English-speaking society benefits from the cultural legacy of the British Isles. And so this course will concentrate on the first highly developed Neolithic culture in Britain, the Windmill Hill culture, whose greatest monuments, whose most durable monuments, were built at Avebury in the county of Wiltshire and 18 miles to the southeast of that at Stonehenge in the same county. The stages of that culture's development produced at first distinctive long barrows, then ritual centers of community life seriously misnamed as causewayed camps, and then finally henges, the functions of which are still hotly disputed by scholars and speculative antiquarians. Avebury was, and in terribly ruined condition still is, one of the world's most massive and mysterious megalithic monuments. To set it in context, we'll take a look at the European continent to try to get a sense of what the term megalithic means. And then we're going to move back to Britain and see how, with the arrival of a new people, the Beaker people, this Neolithic culture of the Windmill Hill area was seriously challenged by new lifestyles. And adaptation and adjustment occurred, and the result was what is sometimes called the Wessex culture, which by 1350 BCE had completed its most distinctive, one of the world's most extraordinary monuments, the great observatory or death temple or whatever it was at Stonehenge. This course ends with a consideration of several aspects of the legacy of Neolithic culture, not only in Western Europe, but in general. We'll consider how agricultural surpluses led to such diverse consequences as population explosion, despite nutritional impoverishment, to inherited differentiation in social standing, class structure in other words, and to the growing importance of warfare. Is the case study suggesting contrary understandings of the last of those two tendencies, the warfare question, we can take a quick look at two Welsh sites, Caer Cadogan and Craig Rhiwarth near Penad Melangath. Then we'll consider how European Neolithic culture, which Gordon Child and others have seen, is the determining and still decisive foundation of European civilization, which means Western civilization in the Americas and now across the world, may have affected modern Western habits and attitudes towards religion, science, and the arts. My first lecture is entitled Definitions and Environmental Preconditions. And this lecture establishes several kinds of definitions to help us understand European Neolithic prehistory. First, we've got to take a look at the neothermal climate change, which produced the basic climate we know today and made possible the discovery and development of agriculture and pastoralism. Then we'll consider the term agricultural revolution and the alternative, in fact, older term, Neolithic revolution. This involves such categories as stone ages, metal ages, such as the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, so-called, still useful in general discussion of human prehistory, despite their defects. Although the Neolithic agricultural revolution that occurred in Southwest Asia between 10,000 and 8,000 BC is the most relevant to this course, being the direct ancestor of the Neolithic cultures of Western Europe from the 5th to the 2nd millennia, this lecture takes a rapid look at the emergence at more than a half a dozen other places on this planet of comparable movements from food gathering to food producing in the Neolithic phase of each of those regions' prehistoric development. Definitions, I think, are usually necessary in understanding historical discussions, and all the more necessary for prehistoric material. In this lecture, we'll consider several terms which have become standard for current discourse on Neolithic culture. Now, this is not a lot of fun. Definitions are not a very exciting way to begin anything, though they're better than counting and classifying bones, it seems to me. But they do appeal to a certain kind of mind, the logical mind. And so let us be logical and begin with the definition, first of all, of some environmental preconditions. The agricultural revolution, as some have termed it, which so decisively altered human life, depended massively on certain species of plants and animals which could only exist in an area in which the climate was conducive to them. And so we have to take a look at those climatic factors. And this means we have to go back to an understanding of what are called interglacial periods. What are interglacial periods? They are the time periods between those periods when glaciers have spread southward and northward from the poles. Sometimes those glaciers have been a mile or more deep. For example, Puget Sound, in which now rise the thriving cities of Tacoma, Seattle, and so on, once lay under nearly 2 miles of ice. We are now living in an interglacial period. Our current interglacial period differs from previous ones in the relative stability of its climate, the relative lack of extreme oscillation between hot and cold, wet and dry, and so on. Weather in this interglacial period has been, until the late 20th century anyway, remarkably predictable. And that predictability has made possible the planting and productive harvesting of food crops, agriculture, and the building of all-season, multi-year settlements on riverbanks and seacoasts, urbanization. Most of the cities of the world are, in fact, related to either seacoasts or navigable rivers. Human civilization, in other words, has been made possible by climatic conditions. Let's hope it'll continue to be as predictable as it has been now that we have gained control of the environment to a degree unimaginable to our forebears. This current interglacial period gives us cause for some concern. It's lasting awfully long, much longer than normal. 10,000 years is the usual length of any interglacial period. And ours, we have had something like 12,000 years since the weather began to change towards the neothermal climate period, the neothermal climate. The global warming produced by modern human technology may permanently change this previously dominant aspect of our environment, with consequences difficult to predict and grim to speculate about. But what was this neothermal climate change? It established the weather in which humans have lived for the last 10 to 12,000 years. This name comes from Greek words for new and for temperature, neos and thermos, new and heat, or new and temperature in general. And what this refers to is the fact that about 11,000 BCE, The glaciers, which had covered much of northern Europe, northern Asia, and northern North America, and which turned the land hundreds of miles to the south of them into subglacial and subarctic tundra, began to melt. In western Asia, those conditions receded rapidly and disappeared. By 9,000 BCE, that part of the world settled down to basically the warm, dry climate it enjoys today, though it was much greener and more humid then, since humans had not yet cut down the forest and destroyed the topsoil by the kind of destructive farming methods which have reshaped the landscape in such a discouraging way. That same process took place more slowly and less destructively to the west and to the north in Europe. Now, some pockets of glaciation survive today in the Alps and the Scandinavian mountain ranges. In the British Isles, the new climate pattern began to appear about 8300, about the time it had established itself in West Asia, and it stabilized in the British Isles about 2,000 years after that. For much of Europe, a very warm period called the climatic optimum occurred about 1,000 years later. Between 5,000 and 3,200 BCE, the temperature was about 3 degrees Celsius warmer, and that means lots more degrees Fahrenheit, and the humidity was higher than in Western Europe today. Now, that humidity and warmth have survived in Western Europe. It is startling that so much of Western Europe is so far north. If we consider that Paris is on a line with something like the city of Quebec, London is on the same line as the center of Hudson's Bay, when we look at the warmth of those parts of the world and the opulent agriculture, the beautiful gardens that they're able to grow, which you won't find in Labrador or central Quebec, then we have to wonder why. And once again, we have to take a look at some of the fundamental shaping factors in human climate. In this case, the Atlantic Ocean, and more particularly the Gulf Stream, which goes way north and which not only brings warmth to those waters and the shores around them, but generates rain clouds that move steadily eastward across Western Europe, as leaving rain and warm rain indeed as far east as Russia, even in the wintertime. The most drastic change caused by the neothermal climate change occurred in the North African plateau we call the Sahara. Today, it's one of the most forbidding environments on Earth. But in the Paleolithic era, before the neothermal climate change, it was a pleasant, grassy series of plains separated by fairly verdant mountain ranges full of game animals and cliff-painting human cultures, a happy and prosperous place. But as the great sheets of ice thousands of miles to the north pulled back, the rainfall declined in those plains, and they dried up, and there was no Gulf Stream in the Atlantic to send the rain moving eastward. And eventually, the inhabitants, both animal and human, of what we now call the Sahara, were forced either to move or to die. That kind of challenge, the challenge of this kind of a major environmental change, presented Paleolithic humans with several alternatives. For the cave dwellers of Central and Southern Europe, the people who painted the caves so brilliantly with the animals in which they lived so very, very well indeed, the challenge was much less acute than for the North African plains dwellers, thanks to the Gulf Stream, but still it was culturally decisive. The animals in which the European cave dwellers depended for livelihood either moved north with the subglacial environment in which they had evolved, or then they dwindled in size and in number. The members of the specialized European Paleolithic hunting cultures had lived from the plentiful meat of mammals, which moved in great herds across the open tundra and meadowlands, and in great schools of fish like salmon, which swam upstream in huge numbers to spawn. Now the hunters had to pursue elusive forest-dwelling animals like deer. They had to catch smaller fish not often found in schools and live off of the shellfish of the shorelines. The opulent Cro-Magnon lifestyle, which had required 1 3/4 square miles for each member of every human group, was doomed. Three alternative solutions to this problem presented themselves. Either you could follow the food supply and change habitat, or you could stay in the same habitat and adapt to new food supplies, or you could change both. The Lapps of northern Scandinavia represent the first choice. Until the 20th century, they've lived in mobile settlements of hide tents, which seem to be remarkably like the leather huts of the Paleolithic hunters of Eastern Europe, a land without caves. The Lapps followed the annual migration patterns of herds of reindeer, which they didn't tame, but which they protected from other predators such as wolves, and thus preserved the reindeer for their own use as food, transportation, and clothing. The opposite alternative, to remain in the old homeland and change as little as possible, attracted many groups, but ultimately led to their extinction. Typical are the painted pebble people of the Pyrenees. These poor people's bones show the baneful effects of malnutrition, and their art shrank to painting rounded stones that are usually unearthed in nests in caves, sometimes smashed, a terrible sign of the obliteration of a people, the obliteration of a culture. The flint tools of the painted pebble people and other comparable cultures are both smaller and less refined than those of their Paleolithic forebears. They are typical of the ingenious but declining technology of what we call the Mesolithic era or Middle Stone Age. Another feature of Mesolithic culture is great variety. One basic Paleolithic culture had stretched from Spain to Russia. After the climate change, dozens of distinct cultures arose, some of them sharing a single, limited geographical area. This pattern of regional breakup and general technological decline has reoccurred several times in the history and prehistory of what we call the West. It's usually led to eventual recovery of creative dynamism and to advance in new directions if one people or one sector of society has responded to the challenge of the environment with inventiveness. Such a revitalization took place in the Western world between 9,000 and 4,000 BCE, thanks to several Mesolithic cultures that opted for a change of both habitat and habit. And that revitalization is often called the agricultural revolution. We have other definitions to deal with. Stone ages, old, middle, and new, Bronze Age, and so on. These are convenient but potentially misleading devices of modern students of the remote past. Christian Thomsen, a Dane, began the whole thing. He was the first curator of the National Danish Museum in Copenhagen, and he invented the term Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age in 1816 as he tried to figure out how to classify and to present in this museum all of these prehistoric objects which had been collected so richly. In 1865, the English antiquarian Sir John Lubbock, who was given the title Lord Avebury later in life, divided the Stone Age into the Paleolithic or Early Stone Age and the Neolithic or New Stone Ages. The term Mesolithic, Middle Stone Age, was soon applied to the cultures seen as transitional between these two. And in time, people decided that the New Stone Age couldn't be separated from the Bronze Age, just very neatly. So we had to have a period when both bronze and stone were used, called the Chalcolithic Age, and so on and so on. Some people now have 10 different stone and metal ages. And there's been a general notion that we should abandon this kind of thing, because it's not very clear that these objects we're talking about were really very relevant as tools which helped produce the basic life. Livelihood on which every culture depends. For example, the tools that gave the Neolithic era its name, in Thomson's mind, are polished stone implements, such as axe heads, mace heads, palettes, or scepters, which are found in sites that almost always yield evidence of agricultural activity. The fact that most of these implements show little, if any, sign of actually being used in hunting or warfare or some such activity and any kind of highly polished stone object is going to show if it has smashed into something or if it's been hit by another object in another direction. It shows it even better than metal blades do, for example. Well, they show very little sign of such use, which suggests to us that their use was largely ritual, which in turn suggests a lot about the complexity of the mental dimension of the cultures with which we're dealing, the cultures which produce and possess these objects as obviously objects of importance to them. Much more sophisticated is the term agricultural revolution. It's a much more sophisticated use of technological terminology, and it considers more than the surviving tools. It's generally used today, however. That revolution is seen as having occurred during the Neolithic era or New Stone Age. So we can speak of the Neolithic revolution or the agricultural revolution as we wish. This sort of terminology, concentrating on food supply rather than on tools, owes much to the work of the great Australian Gordon Child, born in 1892, dying in 1957, who studied classics at Oxford and became a pioneering professor of prehistoric archaeology in Edinburgh. He was a remarkable man who was extremely eccentric, the classic parody of the absent-minded professor. But in his lifetime, he died at 65, he produced some 20 books and hundreds of learned articles, or dozens at any rate, I think well over 100. He was from Australia, as I say, and came to Oxford to study classics. He got hooked into this earlier material by certain pre-classical ceramics, and these led him to pre-classical, to archaic, and all the way further back. And finally, he focused on the period which at that time was called Neolithic because of these polished stone tools, according to people, thanks to the classification of people like Thompson and like Lord Avebury. Child was a person of very distinct and tastes. As I said, he was sort of the classic absent-minded professor. He would tend to wear socks of different colors. The wonderful story that at one point he was going out with his students to a site in Scotland where the grass was tall and wet. The grass is almost always wet in Scotland. And so in order not to become completely soaked, he rolled up his pants underneath his great raincoat. When the group came back, a devoted assistant noticed the great raincoat and bare legs and thought, oh my God, a child has dropped his pants somewhere and tried to help him out, but discovered they were simply rolled up, not dropped. He was a driver who drove with passion, but tended to forget that he was driving and thus run into poles and fortunately in many cases hedges by the side of the road. He would switch languages while lecturing, and people insist that he was not showing off. He actually spoke most modern European languages, and we are told read all of them. I'm always suspicious of claims that someone reads all European languages, but certainly all those that are relevant to the kind of scholarship with which he was dealing, including Bulgarian and Portuguese and so on, not simply the standard French, German, English, Italian, and so on. He, more importantly than these kind of eccentric stories, Child was convinced of several basic things. First of all, that mere attention to tools was inadequate. You had to pay attention to the fundamental facts of life, which involve how you get your food. And so the basic technology, the basic economy, the technology in Child's mind was less important than the economy. He also revived the 19th century idea and gave it great 20th century currency, the idea of diffusionism, that these cultures had all begun way to the east and in the Near East, and that they spread out from the Near East in waves of invasions. This has been much questioned. More importantly, and much less questioned, is Child's contribution in the realm of culture. He really redefined the term culture in the way that is still used by most anthropologists and prehistorians, and I think people simply interested in this general kind of topic. And I'll be talking later about exactly what culture was for him. Basically, though, for Child, man the food gatherer became man the food producer during the Neolithic Revolution, and thus altered the shape and character of human life in the most profound and irreversible ways. Thanks to the kind of thought which Child really impelled forward in very vital fashion, we now can see the agricultural revolution breaking out in five regions on the planet after the neothermal climate change. Food production replaced food gathering. Farming replaced foraging as the basic economic activity, first of all, on the uplands of southwestern Asia, the land between 2,000 and 4,000 feet above sea level, between the mountain ranges and the low-lying river valleys of that region, sometime between 10,000 and 8,000 BCE, even before the climate change had stabilized. The earliest outbreak of this agricultural revolution has had geographically the most widespread impact. It spread very quickly to northeastern Africa, to Egypt, in other words, to southeastern Europe, what we call the Balkans. And its later extensions got as far west as Spain and the British Isles and as far east as India. The typical domesticated plants and animals that characterized that revolution were wheat, barley, and oats, and all of those grains grew wild between 2,000 and 4,300 feet in that Near Eastern zone of what is now Iraq and Turkey and Syria and Palestine. Also, the grapevine, the apple tree, the walnut tree were native there, and the wild ancestors of the domesticated sheep, goat, pig, and dog were native likewise. Now, the transformation of food production occurred shortly thereafter against a very different climatic background in a jungle or a subtropical condition in Southeast Asia. That began about the same time, a little bit later. That's much disputed at the moment, but most people agree that by 4000 BCE, the Southeast Asian agricultural revolution had spread north and west to meet and blend with other Neolithic agricultural traditions in China and in India. Some of its key foodstuffs now used worldwide are rice and the chicken, both domesticated from local native species. The third zone in which the Neolithic Revolution occurred independently is the Yellow River Valley of North China, where agriculture got going about 6000 BC. The basic grain cultivated was wheat, and some speculate that it had been brought there by pre-Neolithic traders, and then who knew about its cultivation. Central America. More exactly, the territory now divided over by Mexico, southern Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize experienced the agricultural revolution also about 5000 BC. The typical domesticated plants were maize, what we Americans tend to call corn, Indian corn, squashes, the tomato, the avocado, peanuts, and several types of beans. Ducks and dogs were the most important food sources in an area which relied much more on plants than on domesticated animal foods. They also ate snake, but no one has ever succeeded in domesticating snakes. So this crucial element of the diet had to be supplied by hunting. Now, this agriculture spread in time throughout the rest of North America. By about 300 BCE, maize was becoming the staple crop of the present state of Ohio. It also spread south to South America, where another outbreak of the agricultural revolution occurred in the uplands of Peru. And there the potato was developed, domesticated, and has become the great contribution. Some say the potato is the most widely eaten food in the entire world today. The Peruvians domesticated, Andeans we should say, the llama, but they didn't eat the llama. Neither of the American agricultural revolutions got going on livestock raising to the extent that the West Asian, the Southwest Asian agricultural revolution did. And that's the one to which we ought to return in our attention, because there the agricultural revolution occurred earlier than anywhere else in the world, and it also spread out from there in a remarkable diaspora. To the northeast into Central Asia, east and southeast into Iran, eventually south into Egypt, and westward across the Mediterranean and up the river valleys of Europe until it reached the British Isles at the end of the world, which people thought the Atlantic coast was, until at least Europeans did, Westerners did, and Asians did, until in the 16th century of our era, Europeans learned how to sail across the oceans and to spread their culture and domesticate in an unpleasant imperialist way the rest of the world to Western civilization, what Child was celebrating and what we now criticize, although we still live within it.
Lecture 2. The Origins of Agriculture and Pastoralism.
This lecture takes a closer, much more detailed look at the first agricultural Neolithic revolution, which occurred between the 10th and the 8th millennia BC in the uplands of Southwest Asia. This is the ancestor and the prototype from which would derive in time the Neolithic cultures of Western Europe. A classic case study of this primeval transformation of human life is the Neolithic village at Jarmo in east central Iraq, which was inhabited for about five centuries by a population of some 150 villagers in each generation, who farmed, with few changes in that period, a simple type of agriculture established 1,000 years before their time. Many aspects of their culture show the opposite of a drastic break with the even older habits of Mesolithic hunter-gatherer foraging. So this is a study in foraging gradually transitioning over into farming. One new form of food production, which affected the life of the Jarmo farmers in a peripheral manner, was pastoralism, or specialized stock breeding and herding, which this lecture will attempt to define. Perhaps the most significant change which agriculture and related forms of pastoralism made possible for the villages of Jarmo and contemporary Neolithic settlements everywhere was a huge increase in population density. The ongoing population explosion of the human species had already begun in the 7th millennium BCE. Now, the arrival of agriculture in any region brings it into the Neolithic or New Stone Age, according to the conventions which we have been using ever since the days of Thompson in Copenhagen, despite the efforts of people like Gordon Child to supplant these terms, Neolithic, New Stone Age, with other kinds of language. Most of the polished stone implements that led archaeologists to apply this name of New Stone Age to the era which we would rather see as the era of the agricultural revolution were luxury items rather than tools for daily use. But they do show a much more sophisticated culture than before. Maybe not much more, but certainly more sophisticated. Jewelry is, in the Neolithic era, fashioned from stone, which is a change from the usual Paleolithic fashion. In the Paleolithic era, people used bone or shells or occasional pieces of blobs of amber and so on. Sometimes even beads were made. But now there are quite striking bracelets and cups apparently not for drinking purpose so much as to serve as repositories for something precious, which will be made from stone that has interesting marble veins in it. So that there's an effort now to move to a kind of artistic jewelry, which we do not see in the Paleolithic at all. Items for cosmetic decoration also appear profusely, such as palettes for body paint. Now, cosmetics were invented way back in the Paleolithic, not even by Cro-Magnon humans, by Homo sapiens sapiens, but by Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, by Neanderthal folk, who developed this application of red paint, at least for burial purposes, and possibly for other purposes as well. Now we know for sure that cosmetics were used in daily life by men as well as women. Once again, the red body paint made from ochre is a favorite product, but it's used apparently to enhance beauty, to serve as rouge, not simply as a sort of an embalming color, which makes the corpse look less deadly dead than it would without that kind of benefit. Objects suggesting distinctive status of individuals appear in finely polished stone, such as scepters and mace heads. And once again, as I mentioned already, many of these objects, which would show if they were actually used to hit something, would show when it's signs of cracking or signs of contusion because of their polishing, show no indication of any use at all, no practical use at least, which suggests that their use, their desirability, their utility must have been as symbols, as ritual objects, enhancing status, just as cosmetic palettes now enhance beauty, and jewelry enhances beauty as well. Jewelry which is made from the difficult material of stone. Metal was welcome wherever it was available. Soft metals, like gold and silver and copper, were worked for practical as well as ornamental use, and all of them were of course, fashioned for trade. The village of Jarmo, which we'll be dealing with, would not appear to have had any goldsmiths, silversmiths, or coppersmiths, but we have objects of copper and of gold in it, pretty puny ones, which have all the signs of being made somewhere else. So this is now entering a new phase. Bronze came next. Bronze is a difficult metal to make in a way. It's an alloy, not nearly as difficult to make as iron. It's an alloy of tin and of copper or some other such metal. Very good for making tools and weapons as well as ornamental objects. Neolithic cultures made use of bronze whenever it was available, likely as a trade good. It's hard to be a metalsmith and a full-time farmer, so specialization became more common, with consequences for social structure and for economic life that we'll be talking about later. Modern archaeology has shown very clearly that there's no neat division between the New Stone Age and the Bronze Age. efforts to talk about a Chalcolithic age when copper as well as stone were used soon began to multiply and multiply, and you had too many intermediate ages. What archaeologists who deal with the study of Western Europe are now tending to do is to see the Bronze Age more as a second stage Neolithic culture rather than as a new era. I'll keep using the term Bronze Age in this course, though, partly because it's so firmly ingrained in our literature, and also because the rise in the use of bronze objects for useful functions as well as for decorative or ritual functions becomes very, very important. But the fundamental notion is that Neolithic cultures maintain their ways of life well after the introduction of bronze technology. Textiles were another development marking off Neolithic cultures. They were an early development of practically all Neolithic cultures, as well as a very typical one. It's been established recently that the Paleolithic cave dwellers of Western Europe, the cultures who painted the great paintings in the caves, wore garments of threaded cloth as well as wool, but those may have been more decorative than functional, possibly even meant to be provocative when worn by the ladies, the stone figures called ladies, which may be priestesses, may be goddesses, may be sex objects. We're not entirely sure. Basic as it may seem to us, textile technology involves complex processes. And so to make it a regular feature of life involves the cultural change, the kind of cultural change we see between the Paleolithic and the Neolithic. Instead of killing a sheep to wear its skin, as any good Paleolithic person would do, humans began to use the sheep's wool over many years to produce the clothing equivalent to that made possible by many different hides. Now, an interesting fact is that the hair of the wild Southwest Asian sheep was in fact nearly useless for this purpose. So Neolithic shepherds must have selected the rams and the ewes with the curliest hair for specialized breeding until they produced what we now consider the normal sheep with the normal kind of maximally usable wool. This marvelous raw material which resulted inspired the invention of spinning, of weaving, of dyeing, and so forth. It was quickly put to other uses than clothing and undoubtedly became an article of trade. As we'll see in our next lecture, we know there was an article of trade in one very important place in the region. Flax was grown not all over the Neolithic homeland of Southwest Asia, but in the uplands of what is today Iraq, and thus made an entirely new material, linen, available for human clothing. Pottery came later than polished bronze work, metal work, and textiles. And it also came rather reluctantly. Various Neolithic cultures do not seem to have wanted to become entirely ceramic, as we say. Many of them remained aceramic for quite a stretch of time. For centuries, Neolithic men and women stored their grain in stone or wooden boxes or baskets or carefully sealed pits. None of these containers offered ideal protection against rodents, but they did the job probably as adequately as anybody expected. It may be that pottery was, like agriculture itself, the product of creative experiment rather than a response to need, either an urgent need or a simpler kind of one. In any case, the arrival of ceramics makes the archaeologist and the historian's job much easier. Clay is a nearly universal material, but endlessly varied in composition, so sources are easy to trace. Once fired, clay is very durable. A pot can easily be broken, but it's very difficult to obliterate. It takes a certain kind of madman to go to the trouble of wiping out and reducing to dust a broken pot or a broken brick or something of that sort. Until modern times, most pottery was decorated according to individual or local group tastes that change constantly. So the records or other pieces of evidence found along with clay pots or their fragments can be arranged in chronological sequences, in ceramic ladders, as archaeologists tend to say. When pots or clay sculpture become handsome enough to trade, it seems to happen very quickly, they become potential data for later studies of far-ranging economic patterns. All these aspects of Neolithic culture emphasize the fact that humankind was moving rapidly from the level of needs dictated by the natural environment to a stage of culture shaped more by human choices and human tastes, by preference, rather than the response to survival. Southwest Asia was home to a great variety of Neolithic cultures after about 10,000 BCE as the neothermal climate change stabilized. A classic instance of a typical Southwest Asian Neolithic culture is well illustrated by the archaeological site at Jarmo, now in east central Iraq. One might say Iraqi Kurdistan, although one is now not certain exactly how much of Kurdistan is going to be allowed to survive. Jarmo, as it's now called, was inhabited from about 6500 BCE to about 6000 BCE. Jormo's population through that five-century period is probably typical of Southwest Asian Neolithic villagers. It was, in other words, a sort of average-sized village, and average also in the speed of its abandonment of pre-Neolithic patterns. The village had about